Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 4:10 p.m. Central Time. Today is Friday, and today being, and it's March 3rd. It's also the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with the total return on treasuries. So let's just imagine we were bright eyed and bushy tailed back in early 1980, and bond yields were peaking. And I don't think anybody was ready for a 40-year bull market, but the total return basically never went down. And that was true until 2022 when it broke the trend. So that's a 5-year moving average that we have up there, and we have a 40-year trend. Now, if you wanted to make money in a big bull market like the bonds, bull market that we had from about 1980 through to 2022, then you bought the dip. And it didn't matter what happened, as long as you bought the dip, anytime there was ever a whiff of doubt about the integrity of the USA and its debt, the sheer volume of debt that had been issued, and the threat of inflation, which everyone has been worried about at one time or another in the last 40 years. As long as you had the temerity to go in there and buy the dip, it worked. And those were beautiful buying opportunities, and you were richly rewarded. And then we had a big event in 2022 where both bonds and equities lost value together. So that really put pressure on the 60-40 portfolio. And let's just remind ourselves, the 60-40 portfolio exists because there's supposed to be an inverse correlation between bonds and equities. And that certainly was not the case last year, where there was a lot of fear about inflation and the impact that it has on a huge quantity of debt. And all of that worry about the cost of servicing the debt. Now, the same arguments that people were worried about last year are equally true today. But that doesn't mean that bond total returns have to still keep going down, because what people are now willing to bet is that inflationary pressures are not as pressing right now as they were a year ago, and that perhaps the story is going to get a bit more friendly. So there's the potential here that bond yields are going to start coming back down. And I will offer at least some evidence to support that view, because when we start looking at the total return on bonds, we have to at least bear some consideration for the volume. And total assets on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet peaked out at 9 trillion, and now they're down to about 8.34. We only have one other example of when they reduced the size of their balance sheet. They took 750 billion out of circulation between about 2018 and the middle of 2019. And that took 18 months, and this time it's taken 9 months. So, same amount of money, twice as fast. So let's just remind ourselves what happened in the bond markets in 2018. So let's just put that yield up. Because in 2018, bond yields went up. And then at the beginning of 2019, they started coming down, and then they surprised on the downside. So let's just remind ourselves that the Fed started reducing the size of its balance sheet about 9 months ago. So 9 months ago was June. And in August, yields started backing up. And they're still rising, although they got up to 4% in here this week and didn't like it much up there. And this could potentially now be a lower rally high. So I think we have to at least pay some consideration to the fact that monetary policy acts with variable and lagged effects. And we are still in an environment where the economy isn't really showing the signs of a slowdown. But the bond market is certainly benefiting from higher yields. So let's just think about the psychology of what happened in 2018. Yields went up because people were worried that the Federal Reserve wasn't going to be buying bonds anymore. And then, because there would be fewer buyers, then yields would rise. And that's exactly what happened. But then the yield goes up enough to become attractive. And then, because they're reducing the size of the balance sheet, they're siphoning liquidity out of the system, then what that contributes to is a fear of deflation. So then yields really contract very quickly. Now, you can't make an argument based upon one simple example. So let's then just also think about what happened when the ECB did the same thing. Now, put aside for the second that the ECB is reducing the size of its balance sheet faster than the Federal Reserve is, and that's the primary reason why the euro has been a bit more firm. So they are now starting to reduce their balance sheet. It's down from 8.8 to 7.8. So they've taken a trillion out of circulation. But they did the same thing in between 2012 and 2014. Now let's remember that. So between basically the middle or to end of 2012 through to the end of 2014, and we'll look at those German bonds. So I really do think that this is worthwhile doing because it gives us a clue to what to expect next. So then in 2012, bond yields were pretty stable. But as soon as they started reducing the size of the balance sheet, we saw the yield go from 1.3 to 2%. And then subsequently, yields collapsed. So I think this is especially relevant right now. We've seen a significant bounce in yields at the same time that the Fed is reducing the size of its balance sheet. Now, the size of the balance sheet isn't the only variable, but we also have the fact that money supply growth is contracting for the first time. So we're really in new territory here. There has never been a time when the size of the Fed's balance sheet was negative. And this is a further example of how they are siphoning money out of the system. It's not simply that the growth rate in the printing of money is no longer at 25% or has contracted from 25 to 20 to 15, but in fact, it is now negative. So they are literally taking money out of the system. So that is certainly something that's going to help with inflationary pressures. But it's very difficult to do this in a tailored manner. So there's the significant potential that what we're going to see is an overshoot, and that we're not just going to see inflationary pressures starting to moderate, but that they will go into reverse, and that what we will in fact see is deflationary fears rising this year. Well, if that is the case, then I think it is quite possible that what we could see is a reversion to the 1,000-day moving average for yields. And that would represent a contraction in the yield from 4% down to about 2.3%. Now, even if that were to occur, then let's just look at lots of back history here. We can see the peak back in 1980. And on every occasion that the yield got above the 1,000-day moving average, the 5-year average, it failed. And it was never able to sustain a move above that for all those years until now. And this is by far the largest overextension relative to the 1,000-day moving average we've seen since the initial counter trend rally in 1984. And that coincided with a good sized recession. So I think that we are now at a very interesting point in the government bond markets. So people have been willing to buy bonds because of the yield. And when we think about the yield that's on offer, well, you can get almost 4%, you can get almost 5% on a 2 year. And 5% pretty much guaranteed is something that is going to attract a lot of people. When there's been so much volatility in the stock market, then that is enough for people to sit on the sidelines and say, well, I don't know what the future is going to hold. So I'm just going to sit on the sidelines. And I think there's a lot of that money is in bonds right now. But that is before we start to see capital appreciation. Because right now, the argument in the bond market is really all about the yield and that you will get your money back when it matures. But the most important driving factor behind the bond market ahead of 2022 was not the yield, it was capital appreciation. So we can definitely think about that in terms of the total of the negative yielding debt, which was up as high as, let me see if we can find it here. And it was up as high as 18 trillion. And now it was almost negative at the beginning of this year and is hovering here around 1.3 trillion. So there's still a deal of Japanese debt and German debt that is negative. All the corporate debt that had a negative yield is now in positive territory. That is obviously going to have a knock-on effect for a really considerable number of European companies. But what it also helps to highlight is that the capital market appreciation for bonds was completely snuffed out over the last 2 years. To me, at least, that suggests that there is going to be a counter trend rally. And then when we think about the longer end of the curve, obviously, longer dated bonds are more interest rate sensitive. So if we are inflation sensitive, so if we start to see inflationary pressures rolling over, much less deflationary forces predominate, then we're going to see a really significant a rally in government bonds. And that's why I've been willing to hold on throughout this setback over the last 3 or 4 weeks, because I really think that the most likely scenario is that we're going to see this ETF back around the 130 level. So if deflation, and of course the deflation will be the ultimate result. On the way there, we'll have disinflation, and that is what is helping to support the stock market. So the S&P 500 was in further positive territory in here today, and it's firming from the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, when we look at the long swing of the secular bull market, by far the most compelling factor is that it finds support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And I like that 1,000-day moving average from a secular bull market perspective, in just the same way that it is useful for just monitoring the consistency of the trend for long-dated bonds or the total return on bonds. It's equally applicable to the stock market. Now, we had a massive overextension here relative to what we might think of as the mean in 2021. And there was the clear potential that it was going to come back and test the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and it did it. It exceeded it briefly in August, excuse me, in October, and has subsequently rebounded. Now, if we do get a deflationary outcome and some of the pressure comes off, the most interest rate sensitive portions of the stock market, there is the potential that we're going to get a more convincing rally. So when we look at some of those more innovation-oriented portions of the market, the ARK Innovation ETF has pulled back in a very dynamic manner. It's down 75% from the peak, even after the rebound we've seen over the last 3 months. and it was a little bit steadier in here today. Now, I'm still of the view that there's a good number of companies are going to go bust. And my animosity towards stocks like Zoom and RingCentral, I think it can't be overestimated. But then we should also consider WeWork. And I think that the people that negotiate bankruptcies and the reworking of covenants are going to be very busy over the course of the next couple of years. So when we just simply look at WeWork's fundamentals, and let's be really simple, they've got cash of 287 billion, a million, excuse me, and they expect to spend 210 million this year. And that's on debt of 19 billion. So it's pretty sure that the company's going bust. And the only possible way they're going to survive is if they do one of two things. They either decide they're going to go bust and then default on all their leases, get rid of the most expensive and least productive leases, hold on to their best earners, and then relist. Or they'll use the threat of doing that to go and renegotiate their leases with their existing landlords. So one way or the other, it's going to either be a disorderly bankruptcy or it's going to be an orderly one. But in either case, the chances are that the stock is not going to be listed any longer. Or if it is, then it could be at a substantially lower value than what it is at now, and it's now only trading at a dollar. Now, we have seen similar kinds of events previously. And what we're now starting to see too in the commercial real estate sector. And sometimes I do think that I have to pay attention to what happens in my own life, because I got a flyer in the door a few months ago from a hedge fund trying to raise capital from homeowners. So to me at least, that was already a red flag that when a hedge fund goes to the postal service and is looking for people in postcodes with or then where I would live, and then also inviting me to a free dinner so that they can pitch their strategy. To me at least, that was already a sign of a change in the trend. But what I found most specifically interesting was the kinds of assets that some of the other people who were invited to that talk were in. Because there was one lady who had divorced from a very wealthy individual, and her assets had almost all been invested in the BlackRock institutional real estate or REIT. And that is one of those that is defaulting on some of its loans. And Starwood has been defaulting on its loans, and Blackstone has just this week defaulted on a CMBS in Sweden. So Swedish property prices are coming down, and what these companies are doing is making a calculated decision that they are better off deciding that they're going to stop making payments on their buildings and that they have a better chance of coming out positive by going through bankruptcy. So then we have companies like Oaktree that are putting together funds to buy distressed debt. And the most important thing is that these kinds of events, they do occur, but we're seeing quite a number of them starting to develop right now. So we do have examples of what that looks like. And we can think about it in terms of the offshore drilling sector. So Noble Corp was a storied drilling company that has its origins in the 1920s, and it survived multiple recessions along the way and booms in oil prices, crashes in oil prices, but it could not survive the pandemic, and it had to declare bankruptcy. And since then, it's renegotiated, refloated on the stock market in 2021. Didn't really do anything for the first 9 months, but now it's starting to recover again. And these companies have basically been able to offload their debt. So we can see here now that Noble Corp has only got about 400 million in debt against a market cap of 6 billion, and it has a free cash flow of about 162 million and estimated to go up by more than three times in 2024. Well, that's a very different environment to a company like WeWork. So it's not like people won't have offices or they won't need offices. And I suspect that with a lot of these companies that are defaulting on their offices, there is probably going to be a push to bring people back into the office and to actually use some of this infrastructure. But most particularly, what's happening now with the offshore drilling, and there's quite a number of them that went bankrupt in 2021 and are now starting to recover. So Seadrill would be another. And again, it's a very good example of a company that has now got no debt. Now, it doesn't mean that they don't have covenants on some of their retired drilling infrastructure, where they'll have to make a payment to a legacy bond holder at some point in the future. But that's only going to be on the expectation that there is income coming from some of those assets. So definitely, it's not impossible that some of these companies will be able to completely absolve themselves of the responsibility for their debt. But of course, it does beg the question, who lent them money? So I think it's interesting here that Blackstone was in positive territory in here today. Now, the share is down quite heavily from 150 all the way down to 70 at the beginning of this year. It had a good size counter trend rally, but did not break the trend. And now we're seeing it well off the low in here today. So there's the potential that it is putting in a higher reaction low. If we get upside follow through next week, then that would also be really quite impressive. But I think it's also really worth considering right now that with the bullish action that we're seeing in both bonds and equities, that we still have an inverted yield curve. It became more inverted in here today. So it was at negative 88 basis points yesterday. It's negative 90 now. This is the difference between the 10-year and the 2-year. And it's more negative now than it has been since the early 1980s. And if we look at a couple of others, so this is the difference between the 10-year and the 3-month, which generally tends to be more volatile and contracted by 300 basis points in 2022 alone. And it's also at its deepest level of inversion that we've seen in decades. Now, if we then spin that out and look at an even longer duration, the difference between the 30-year and the 3-month, then we're also at almost negative 100 basis points. And it is also at the most inverted it has been since the 1980s, the early 1980s. And of course, that was the peak of the last interest rate hiking cycle and coincided with a really significant recession. So then let's also just pay attention to the fact that the inversions are generally not when the worst of the selling pressure occurs in the stock market. It is after the inversion that you get the selling pressure. So it's when these yields start, or these spreads start moving up through the 50 basis point level and all the way on the return journey up to about 400 basis points, at least on this spread. I think it's more like 250 basis points on the 10-year minus the 2-year. But it is in this accelerating up period that we get the most selling pressure. Now, it's worth also considering that this became very briefly inverted in 2019 and then popped on the upside, and we had selling pressure in the early part. But then we had a big stock market rebound in this period right here. So that's a very different environment to what we'd seen in previous occasions. And now we've had this big inversion and it's still inverting. As long as it's still inverting and continuing to go deeper, then that is a reflection of markets rewarding assets because or at least investors rewarding asset prices because the Federal Reserve is deemed to be doing something about inflation. It's usually when they overshoot, and then there are real fears of deflation, that we start to see the yield curve spread pushing back up quickly because they have to cut rates and do so in a hurry. And usually stock markets don't do particularly well at the beginning of that phase. So what I'm anticipating here is that we're going to get a good sized rebound in the stock market. And then subsequently at that we're going to get the weakness. And then it's really a question of where do the lows eventually start to come back in. Then what could in fact be a catalyst for some deflationary forces? So one thing that is certainly happening right now is that between the front month and the second month of Brent crude, we're back in a backwardation. And historically, it's at the peaks. It's when this spread changes direction that we start to see changes of trend in the oil market. And this is a pretty significant change of trend. It went from a backwardation of $6 in July of 2022 to a contango of about 65 cents. And now we are up at a backwardation of 60 cents. So the thing that I've been very keen to highlight is that oil prices don't spend a lot of time ranging. They tend to be very volatile. And we've been in a range, a $10 range now, for most of the last 3 months. And there's a medium-term sequence of lower rally highs. There is a short-term sequence of higher reaction lows. It is locked between the 1,000 and the 200-day moving averages. And these types of very tight range tend to be resolved with emphatic breakouts. So if oil breaks up through the 200-day moving average and pushes up through the 90 level, then the chances of a really significant rally up towards 120 or in excess of that will be greatly enhanced. And of course, the opposite is also true. If we start to see it coming down through the 1,000-day and we're pulling down through the $80 area, most particularly 76, then we could get a significant collapse down through 40. So what happens in oil prices is obviously going to be important for global growth. And we get inflationary fears first, and then deflationary fears because it is a tax on consumption. And of course, most particularly a tax on consumption among consumer nations. So let's then just think about what's happening in terms of the dollar. So the dollar index got all the way up to test 105 and is now starting to ease back again. The fact that the ECB is reducing the size of its balance sheet faster than the Federal Reserve is helping to support the euro, even if the Fed is raising rates faster than the euro. I think those factors are kind of balancing each other out. But Europe definitely has had a good sized rally for the simple reason that they spent as much money as was required to ensure that natural gas prices did not kill the economy. And they were buying with absolutely no regard for price until they filled their reserves in Europe. As soon as those reserves were filled, they stopped buying and the price collapsed. So European gas prices continue to pull back down. And now it's going to be the job of US exporters to take the place of the Russian imports into Europe. So US natural gas prices have really accelerated down to the $2 area and are now rebounding. So they're up 50% in the space of 2 weeks. And this is quite likely to be a big counter-trend rally. We could see prices double again from here. And that would take them up to about six. I suspect that it's unlikely prices are going to go much beyond that. But at least they'll come back to test the region of the 1,000-day moving average, which would be another 50% advance from where they are right now. Or in terms of futures, that's going to be at least another 1,500 points. So there's certainly the potential here that prices are going to rally. And then that is likely to act as a significant benefit for some of these rather depressed natural gas producers. And even though natural gas was in positive territory today, Southwest Energy was negative. And Devon Energy wasn't able to capitalize on its advance. EOG was in more positive territory, and it has pushed back above the 120 area, so it's looking increasingly likely that it's a failed downside break. So then let's turn our attention to Europe. The Euro Stoxx index continues to advance. So Europe is back on the front foot, and there are, I think, two big reasons here. The first is that they're not experiencing the kind of recession that was expected, because governments spent as much money as was required. And that is the additional reason, that because they spent so much money, then that was a huge flood of liquidity. So even though the ECB is withdrawing some of that liquidity, they haven't been as aggressive in raising rates. And they've been very clear in stating that they are erring on the side of caution. They do not want to overshoot in raising rates, whereas the Federal Reserve has said in very plain English that they think that the risk of overshooting is less than the risk of undershooting, because they have a very clear effort to try and get inflation under control. There hasn't been a lot of talk about the rising cost of servicing the debt of late, and the primary reason for that is because investors are willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the Fed that they will get inflationary pressures under control. And I think that is the more likely scenario. And any upward pressure that we get on the cost of servicing the debt in the short term will be absolved by falling yields later. But we are in a more benign environment for Europe. And then there is the valuation differential. If the euro is firming, then Europe becomes more attractive from a valuations perspective. And the PE on the Euro Stoxx is only about 13.5. Now, the FTSE 100 has been pausing here in the region of its all-time peak over the course of the last couple of weeks. These exceptionally lengthy ranges generally give way to the biggest bull markets. That's why we talk about ranges being explosions waiting to happen. So sentiment towards the UK is really quite negative, but there is a reason for that, and it's that you have floating rate mortgages in the UK, and it's exactly the same problem in Australia. where the vast majority of mortgages are floating rate. So even though the FTSE 100, which is the large cap, more internationally oriented index, is pushing to new highs, and the FTSE 250, which is the domestic index, more representative of what's happening in the UK economy, has broken its downtrend and is firming from the region of the 200-day moving average. Sentiment is very negative, and the reason is that the Bank of England is talking the market down. So they are inhibited from raising rates because large numbers of mortgages are going to reset this year, and it's going to represent a very significant jump in the cost of servicing a mortgage for a large proportion of the economy. So they are inhibited from raising rates to try and get inflationary pressures under control. When we look at that year-over-year CPI figure for the UK, it's still at 10%. Now, 10% is better than 11%, and it does look like it's starting to come back down, but it's been coming down a lot slower than other places, and that's because the Bank of England has been inhibited from aggressively raising rates because of the impact it would have on the property market. So then they don't have much choice than to resort to really talking negatively about the economy and basically trying to disincentivize people from going out and spending money. They're trying to restrict economic activity by talking about it. And then the pound has been really exceptionally volatile for the last couple of years, but quite steady over the last couple of months. So having rebounded quite impressively from the pension panic sell-off in Q3, it's hovering here around the 120 area, and this is the lower side of the overhead trading range. So it's a natural area where traders are going to start thinking about beginning to buy once more, or at least looking for support to start coming in here. If we then think about Australia in the same terms, it's not called the lucky country for no reason. And Australia was able to avoid the worst of the property crash that really took down the global economy in 2007 and 8. But then the impact of relying on China for much of its export market has weighed on the economy, and inflationary pressures have taken off. And then a large number of people have floating rate mortgages there too. The Australian dollar got down to test the 60 cent level, has rebounded not as impressively as the pound. It's a little bit steadier in here today, but it's got some work to do. And then let's just look at the materials sector in Australia, because this is going to be where import, where dollars are going to be imported from. So the materials in index really popped on the upside in here this week, and it looks like an upside weekly key reversal. So that's from a very short-term decline. And there is obviously the potential here that we're going to see additional upside. And of course, that is feeding through from China's economic growth. So China's PMI surprised on the upside in here this week. Now, I don't think that's a coincidence that the Party Congress is next week. So positive economic figures are to be expected ahead of the Party Congress, particularly when the governance of the Communist Party has really been questioned by citizens protesting on the streets to try and end the COVID zero policies back in October and November. So manufacturing activity has popped back up above 50. So it's back in expansion and it's the fastest jump we've seen in years. That's certainly worthy of some enthusiasm. It's definitely helping to stoke interest in the broad swathe of the resources sector. So the BlackRock World Mining Trust has an almost identical pattern to the ASX 200's material index. And we can round that out by looking at the materials index in Canada, too. Now, Canada's hasn't been doing quite as well, but that was certainly a big dynamic move, bouncing here from the middle of the range that's been forming for the last over 2 years in here this week. Now, of course, there's the additional question. What kind of materials are going to be mined? Where is the demand growth driver going to be? So the big move in commodity prices between about 2002 and 2008 was iron ore. Now, we don't have the price history that for this spot price in Qingdao, but well, I guess we can look at Vale as a good example of that. That it was almost a pure play on iron ore before it bought Inco. So Vale is also steadying in this range that's been forming, but the size of the move we've had is nothing even coming close to the size of the move that we had between 2003 and 2008. So we can really say that that was a big bull market in iron ore. There was lots of steel manufacturing going on in China. They were industrializing, they were building a city the size of Manhattan every year, or it was more than that. It was some ridiculously fast pace of building. And they don't need to build more cities. Now, places like India need to build cities. Africa needs to industrialize if they're going to provide an improving standard of living for the billion new people that are going to be born in Africa over the course of the next 30 years, then significant industrialization is absolutely inevitable. And the fact that they have they're at least they're on the cusp of agreeing a continent-wide free trade zone is a really important development for just about every African country. But it does beg the question, if we're seeing these resources sectors breaking higher, what's going to be the key source of demand? Is it going to be the urbanization of large portions of the global economy, or will it be something else? Well, I think steel is a bit of a no-brainer in many respects because it's essential to absolutely everything. So to the extent that we get any kind of infrastructure development, then steel production will be a big portion of that. And that's also why the largest cap mining companies generally also have big iron ore production facilities. But then copper is the other big one. And it's an essential component of every form of renewable energy. So China represents 50%, it's actually 54% of all processing and consumption of copper. So what happens in China is going to have a material effect on copper, but it is still trending higher. And companies like Freeport-McMoRan are bouncing here and doing so in a pretty dynamic manner. So ahead of a recession, it's quite normal to see a big jump in the performance of the materials sector, and we're starting to see that. They're not going to be immune from a recession, but that doesn't mean that they won't recover quickly. So then it, of course, begs the question, if we're going to have higher energy prices and higher materials prices, and I'm basically looking for a rebound in government bond prices because they're so oversold, but the trend, the long-term trend has been broken. Well, in the meantime, before we start to see the eventually bonds starting to roll over again, then with contracting yields, the technology sector can do better. So here we have the eight large Fangman plus Tesla companies relative to the total market cap of the entire US market. So it massively underperformed from the end of 2021 through to the beginning of this year, a full year of significant underperformance, where those eight companies at the peak represented a 23% share of the total market, got down to 16%, and is currently around 19.5%. But that's a substantial breakout this week. And it's certainly helping to support the view that a share like Apple will be able to hold the region of the 200-day moving average. We could easily see the share price rebound and go back and test the peak before a recession eventually starts to break. There is the potential, of course, that a recession will not be confirmed until perhaps 2024. And in the meantime, we could get a good-sized rally in both bonds and equities. You don't generally get a recession until everyone is convinced that it's impossible. And there were so many fears about a recession at the end of 2022 that a rebound perhaps was more likely than not. Then, of course, we should consider what's likely. Well, we can't forget that there is a geopolitical environment. There are geopolitically sensitive portions of the world. And armaments are likely to be a really significant portion of any bull market in the future. So when we look at, for example, BAE Systems, the share has popped on the upside, and it completed that lengthy range between 2017 and 2022, found support at the upper side of that range, and then popped back up again. Every country in Europe needs to rearm, and Russia is making a very clear bet. They're betting that they will last longer than NATO, because they have more tanks and they will use up more of NATO's armaments, so that Europe will be basically denuded of armaments before Russia runs out of men and machinery, and then they will be in a better position. So then obviously the pressure is on the defense sector to ramp up production, and that's basically what's happening. So governments are basically telling them to invest in new manufacturing capacity, and that that productive capacity will get bought. So we're still seeing the defense sector doing better. But of course, if we, and I think it is worth considering that NATO is running down its armaments, Russia is absorbing really significant losses, and China is sitting on the sidelines with its arsenal completely intact. So they are literally biding their time. They are currently in a position similar to what the USA was in ahead of World War, ahead of the USA's entry into World War I and World War II, where they had their military and manufacturing capacity completely intact while the wars were going on, and then came in a strong position in the middle of the war. And I suspect that that is basically what China is attempting to achieve on this occasion, even if its military is not as large as the USA's is. But it does, of course, beg the question whether Taiwan is a particularly secure area. And there's a lot of investment going on to try and build out semiconductor manufacturing capacity outside of Taiwan. So the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index is bouncing from the region of the 200-day moving average, and it has broken its downtrend. So this is really quite encouraging action, and it suggests that we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Now, of course, it does beg the question, do we get a soft landing, a hard landing, or no landing? Well, the most important thing, I think, is that as long as the yield curve spread is still contracting, we give the benefit of the doubt to the upside one way or the other. And as long as high yield spreads are not marching higher, then a lot of the issues that assail the REIT sector or the highly valued no profits sector, they'll probably be reasonably well contained. So let's just think about that. The high yield spread is rolling over. So that's suggesting that some of those issues with the high yield sector are probably going to be contained. And there is, of course, the other big important point that in previous cycles, the USA was an energy importer. So higher prices impacted growth. But now the USA is a major energy exporter. And there's a real significant push to build electric vehicles. Now, whatever one's view about electric vehicles, and I certainly don't own one, and I don't really have much intention of buying one. But the reality is that it subsumes the need for gas or gasoline, and replaces it with electricity generation. Now, Lithium Americas broke ground on the Thacker Pass mine today, and that mine alone has enough of lithium to supply most of the automotive sector in the USA. It's not like they're going to be producing there this year or even next year, but it's a really significant event, and the share price is really only just beginning to rebound. What it definitely also helps to highlight is that there are new sources of supply coming to market, and that they're not all controlled by China. And Allkem in Australia, with significant operations in Argentina, is also rebounding here. And that was an upside key reversal to hold the succession of higher reaction lows. Now, lithium prices have probably peaked, but I don't think it's a question of whether they've peaked, but rather, where are they going to find support? There's plenty of lithium around. We've had major bull and bear markets in lithium because there isn't an accurate matchup between when lithium supply increases and when demand for electric vehicles increases. So there's the strong likelihood lithium prices are going to come back down, potentially test the 200,000 level, but then probably bounce. And regardless, US domestic onshore lithium production is going to be a boom industry, and particularly in a geopolitically tense environment. So there is also the geopolitical security of the wider market. Now, when we think then about Saudi Arabia, well, they benefit from rising energy prices, and their index is steadying here in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. They own a big chunk of Lucid Group, and it's really an open secret that they're waiting to reveal how much lithium they have internally until lithium, or excuse me, until a Lucid Group announces that they're going to build a factory for manufacturing and electric vehicles and processing lithium in Saudi Arabia. There's a real change of trend going on, where governance is improving in the Middle East, probably faster than most areas. And there's a bit of a tiff going on right now between Saudi Arabia and the UAE. But it's a question really more about the who's going to be the leader. But they're definitely also supporting one another in driving governance improvements in places like Egypt and Pakistan. So certainly there is a lot of interesting activity going on. The one thing we know for certain is there will be an extra billion people that will need to be employed in the global economy over the course of the next 20 years. That means there's going to be higher demand for everything. And we're definitely also going to see a lot more money put into mitigating carbon emissions. And the carbon price got up to test the 100 euro level in here this week and has paused. So it's starting to come back down again. But Europe wants it up at 130, and it will eventually get there. And they want it at 130 to support a domestic green hydrogen industry. And Europe is also becoming more nationalistic and attempting to enforce its own carbon policies on anyone who's exporting into the region, which of course is inherently protectionist. But there is also an attempt to deliver a free trade agreement on renewable energy with the USA. So it's not like just because oil prices are marching higher that people have forgotten about the outlook for renewable energy and the need to mitigate carbon emissions. That trend isn't going anywhere. And there will continue to be a drive towards higher carbon prices and more energy efficiencies. But I think the easiest way to frame that is that Europe is and China are major energy importers. And it's in their interests to thrift and to support the view that carbon emissions need to be curtailed in order to reduce consumption of imported energy. I don't think you can get to a carbon-free environment without uranium. And the uranium ETF is firming from the $20 area. And I suspect that we have significant room on the upside to move. Interest rates are always going to play a role in technology. So when we think about small modular reactors, NuScale Power has contracts, and they are beginning to put their manufacturing capacity together. They've been able to negotiate to place those small modular reactors in old coal-fired power stations. So then they have all the environmental regulations all lined up to get that done. But none of that is going to change the fact that it's going to be about 2027 before they get their first one operational. And between now and then, they're probably going to need a fair share of money. And Fluor is looking to sell. So I don't know why that's not working. There we go. Fluor owns a big chunk of that company. And as an engineering powerhouse, then it's still marching higher from here. And they're going to sell their, I think it's almost half of NuScale when they believe that they can get an attractive price for it. And they're going back to a less asset intense business model. But that's a simple reflection of interest rates, that holding on to long duration assets when you're not raising income out of them is fine when interest rates are zero. When interest rates rise, well, then you need income. So that's what Fleur is doing. They're trying to move to an asset-light business model, and the market is rewarding them for it. And of course, General Electric has basically done the same thing, that they've got rid of all of their business units and they're back as an industrial company. And the share is beginning to be rewarded for that transition. So it's coming up to the upper side of its base formation. And then Rolls-Royce was really punished during 2020, and that was purely because flight demand evaporated, and half their business is service contracts. So as the global economy picks up, and planes need to be serviced, and turbines need to be serviced, and demand for defense starts to improve, well, then that's also helping to support the share price. And it's on the cusp now of completing its base formation. So we definitely have evidence of demand returning. That's despite the fact that monetary conditions continue to tighten. I remain very much of the view that we do have a deflationary shock out there in the future. Between now and then, we could have a good size rally, and we'll have, I think, plenty of evidence in the bond markets to tell us when the liquidity tightness becomes a real problem for stock markets, most particularly from those yield curves. And of course, with the dollar easing back somewhat and more interest in commodities, gold has popped on the upside in here, and that's also an upside weekly key reversal. So it needed to find support in the region of the moving average. It has done so, and I suspect that we're going to see new highs in gold before the end of the year. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.